Great. Thank you, Michelle. I should get Michelle to send me that nice summary of family systems theory. I think I really enjoyed that. I think the important piece to say, probably following on from what Michelle's introduced, is that family systems theory is not a Christian theory. So it was a theory about relationships originally kind of devised by a guy called Dr. Murray Bowen in the 50s, 60s, 70s, working as a psychiatrist on the east coast of the States. And from there, it's been teased out and applied in thinking about relationships and lots of different kind of configurations of people, human relationships and all sorts of things from there. And it really, from its inception, it was taken up actually by some Jewish leaders and Christian leaders following on from that in quite a big way. And so it's always had a kind of trail in application in kind of Christian organisations and thinking about Christian relationships, but didn't start there. So that's probably just helpful with a little bit of background as well. Now, what I'm hoping to do this evening is to share some material that really gets us thinking about relationships and maybe even to see them in a new or different way. In the work that I do with people, I think it is the ability to see the relationship and to kind of get outside of it and see it and to think about it that can really open up opportunities and unstick some things that can get stuck. So a caveat, if you have come along for tips and tricks about what to do to fix a relationship, or as I get requests for more often, to fix another person in a relationship, I'm letting you know you're going to be vastly disappointed by this evening. But stay with me as we try and step back and get a glimpse of what's happening, really when we bump up against each other in relationships and what this opens up. So I just want to say that whether you're here thinking about a marriage or you're sandwiched between caring for generations of other people, or you're thinking about friendships, or you're thinking about work relationships and your colleagues, or even thinking about relationships at church, I'm hoping that as we take a big picture on view on relationships, that there'll be something for everyone as we move through this. So let's see. What I'm going to start with is actually a... This is going to hijack your Q&A for Slido. I'm going to get you to scan this QR code for Slido. We're going to do a word cloud. So what I want you to do is grab your phones, snap that QR code and pop into that little kind of section for an answer. What makes a healthy relationship? So if you had to capture in one word, or you can put a couple of words in as different entries if you want to, what do you think is a healthy relationship or makes up a healthy relationship? There's a big green one there already. Yep. This is great, isn't it? I love it. Lots on communication, honesty, trust, love, humility, good communication, respect, sacrifice, compassion, compromise, maturity, commitment, forgiveness, love, humility. All right. Gosh, no wonder relationships are hard. It's a lot there, isn't it? Yep. All right. Thanks, everyone. Isn't that so interesting to see? And there's a lot of crossover. There's a lot of familiarity there, but there's a lot that actually requires quite a lot of hard work when I look at that as well. But the reason I really like to do this is because I think this highlights that everyone here has a pretty good sense of what a healthy relationship is and what it's made up of. And these are beautiful words, aren't they? I'm not going to stand up here and tell you to suck eggs and try and tell you that all these things are important. I think you know that. What we're going to talk about is how do you actually put in the effort to build this? What does that take? So what I want you to do is to just take a moment and talk to the person next to you about that question. What do you think it actually takes to build a relationship like that and for a relationship to be like that? So just 1 or 2 minutes, what do you think goes into that? All right, I'm going to stop you there. I'm sure there's loads more. And I would love to hear what you said there, but I'm going to move on and introduce you to a family that I know. So I'd like you to meet Ben. So Ben is a force to be reckoned with. He's energetic and enthusiastic. When he is committed to something, he is deeply committed and admired for his persistence in channeling his energy to the nth degree. He thrives on adrenaline, which, to be honest, can sometimes get him into trouble, but this goes hand in hand with his entrepreneurial nature. He has big ideas, but as you can probably imagine, is a fairly intense character and can sometimes be a bit too much for people to handle in big doses. Ben is the oldest of three children. His brother Sam, who is younger than him, is a completely different character. He's a laid-back kind of guy, far less driven than Ben, and just kind of sails where the wind blows. He has a big network of friends and is a personable guy. And because of this, he always has someone he can call on for whatever he needs. He's pretty resourceful in this way. As you can imagine, he drives Ben crazy, which Sam knows and kind of enjoys, which keeps playing out in the conflicts that they have between them. And then they have periods of kind of little to no contact. Their younger sister, Sarah, has grown up navigating life with these two older brothers, and for the most part of it, has found the best way to do this is just to get on with her own thing. She is intelligent and competent, quick in conversation and sharp-witted. She's likable, but people are a bit wary of her, as it's not always entirely clear where she stands. Her boyfriend, Tom, adores her and would do anything for her. They also have an older half-brother, Cameron, from their father's first marriage. Cameron is a bit removed from the happenings of this family until he needs to be involved in something or another. He would like to be more successful than he is. He hasn't quite found his way or his direction yet, but he keeps trying. Their father, Rob, is a very successful businessman. And growing up, the kids didn't see him much while he devoted much of his time and energy into the business. This meant they were financially well off, but their father was often absent and some might have described a bit distant or cold. This, however, didn't dampen each of the kids wanting their father's approval or nod of the head, which was extremely hard to come by. This was true for all of the kids, but they each dealt with it differently. Ben was most interested in their father's work, which perhaps added to his wanting his approval a bit more acutely at times. Their mother, Elizabeth, kept a very strict house, which revolved around opportunities for the kids and was shaped by the business of the time. Now, the thing about this family is that when things were calm, things rolled out pretty smoothly. People knew their places, they had contact with each other to a bearable amount, but they also had enough of their own thing going on that they weren't in each other's way. Like any family, when people stuck to this, it had a kind of state of equilibrium that carried on. And even if they weren't that happy with it, the risk of unsettling it was too big to do anything differently. This is the case in any relationship system, that the system can adapt itself to being calm enough to operate and function well enough to keep things going. But when the system comes under pressure, whether this is pressure from someone inside the system, like in the family, or something outside the system pushing for change, the fault lines are exposed. And so in Ben's family, like any family, when people got more stressed and things got more intense, this began to show up in their relationships. For this family, the intensity dial was turned up when Rob became unwell, and that's the father, so unwell that it became apparent he was probably not going to be able to continue his work. This set a whole series of events into play. There was worry about him, but what happened was all the energy each person had been putting into trying to keep things rolling on kind of unraveled and seemed to fuel a lot of intensity. Ben got involved, like really involved, in what was happening. He was already working in the family business, but he took his chance to really try and prove that he was ready to take on the top job. But Rob didn't agree. In fact, he went to lengths to demonstrate this by declaring he wasn't going anywhere. Under pressure, we begin to see how this emotional system moved when it got uncomfortable. Ben tried to ally with everyone and anyone, seeking reassurance. Here we go. Seeking reassurance to try and establish himself. Cameron removed himself even more than ever. Sam argued with his father, a lot of conflict there, and anyone who would listen to him. Sarah, more subtly, tried to get people to listen to her by getting them on side. Rob's wife, Elizabeth, stayed out of it as much as she could. And Rob, well, he had an acute medical episode and was hospitalized. And weirdly, Tom proposed to Sarah in the middle of all of this. Now, if you haven't picked it, welcome to the Roy family from the TV show Succession, as I was describing them. This family might be entirely new to you, or you might be very familiar with them. This is only episode one of Succession. Can you believe it? That all happened in episode one. Now, this might not be the family that comes to mind when we're talking about healthy relationships for so many reasons, but they are a really good example of a family relationship system because they're one where we can see them operating as a whole unit, where each member acts and reacts and interacts with all the other members of the family all the time, minute by minute, day by day, year after year. Now, I could have chosen lots of other families to illustrate this same point, if you think about these ones. Some healthier than others, won't say which ones. Families as emotional systems where there's constant shifting and adapting to get comfortable and to make life work. Now, most of the time, families do this and relationships do this in a really remarkable way. The family's pretty good at finding a balance of this, but there are times when these relationship systems come under stress and we see patterns in relationships emerge more clearly and the attempts to try and get things to calm down again. And that's what we're going to have a closer look at tonight, the way we adapt in relationships, what we try and do to make them work, and what we might think of as helpful or unhelpful. So where are we headed? So firstly, we're going to have a think about what happens automatically in relationships and between human beings, what we can expect. Secondly, we're going to think about where our emotional energy is going in relationships. And finally, we'll get on to some thinking about why healthy relationships begin with each person working on their own emotional maturity, which I think is the good news and the bad news of a systems thinking approach. And we'll think about what an emotionally mature relationship might look like. And by then, hopefully, I'll run out of time for too many hard questions at the end. Okay, so to start with, I want to do a very short history of emotions, a very brief dive into this. So I find this really fascinating. I'd love to do more thinking and work on it. But I think having a little bit of background in this helps us to understand what happens automatically in relationships. So Thomas Dixon, a historian on the history of emotions, says that in the most literal sense of the term, emotions are movements. And so if we look at this, we see that the word emotion has its root in the Latin verb emover, which means to move out or displace or expel or disturb. And it also has close verbs in French, Spanish, Italian, all of which share this sense of motion and agitation. And it's only in the 19th century that these definitions begin to include feelings and the language of feelings. And so I just think that's really interesting. We get this really physiological sense of emotion, being moved, kind of being agitated, kind of needing to do something, a stirring up. And then only a bit later on, it kind of morphs into this language around emotions, which is a more kind of cognitive, psychological kind of process. I think all of these capture something of what happens for us when emotion is triggered. We get stirred up, we get agitated, and as part of this, we're automatically moved to want to do something with it to get comfortable again. Now, if we were to do a really deep dive into this, which we won't, but I'll just mention because I find it really interesting, is that having a bigger picture on this helps us to see that other species are also driven by emotion, and that this is the idea of a natural systems theory where there's a whole lot going on at this level. So animal behavioural scientists talk about how it is emotion in this sense that helps birds and bees and ants and all sorts of other animals navigate what is needed in a group and to survive, to work out what their own role is, how they communicate and interact with other members of their species and how they work that out without language. Isn't that fascinating? So we probably have more in common with the ants and bees that we might have thought. And I think this idea of seeing emotion as a natural process where a creature gets stirred up and is moved to act is a helpful premise for us to think about our own relationships. Just as a side note, I think as Christians, this is also really interesting to think about, to be reminded of our creatureliness in this sense, that we were created and made by God, and that we are a species that live and interact in these finite bodies that we have. So what does that mean? What does that look like? You know, there is a spiritual aspect in our being, of course, but in this creation, we are in our bodies and relating to one another in these bodies that we have. And so I think that's really interesting. And so I think it's only a small step further to think about this physiological aspect of this and to think about how we naturally kind of make relationships work. Especially if it's an emotion that is uncomfortable, we move automatically to try and get comfortable again by trying to outsource it or avoid it, doing away with it, sharing it with someone else, or trying to find a quick fix that makes it a little bit easier. So in systems thinking, one of the things we talk about is at the heart of what's going on here is this seesaw in relationships of togetherness and separateness in relationships, which takes constant navigating and a kind of dance. So most of this we do without realizing it. We're seeking out more time or contact with people when we need it. We're finding people to agree with us or share our ideas. We're drawing on the relationships around us for the practical or emotional support that we need. Or at the other end, we're finding ways to distance ourselves and to do our own thing or to get away from the group and explore, come up with our own ideas and develop skills with some autonomy to do things on our own that in turn maybe we take back to the group as well. So this constant kind of going between these. And this is how relationships work. It's a natural flow that's shaped by our biological wiring, this dance of kind of separateness and togetherness. We need each other, for sure, and we need space as well to be separate people. But too much of one or the other, and it can take things into a zone of real discomfort in a relationship. So too much togetherness, and people want to get away from it because it's too much. It's like it's too suffocating. But when there's too much distance in a relationship, it can make people feel really anxious that they're not needed and kind of try and pull people back in a relationship. Now imagine we see this play out with our friendly family, the Roy family. Imagine we step right back and see this dance play out. Their need for space and autonomy and to be separate selves, but the way they navigate kind of needing each other and the pulling each other in, who reacts to who over time in this. If we watch their movements kind of towards and away from each other, we can see, even without language, which is good because there's so much swearing in the show, who do they talk to? Who do they avoid? Who are they getting close to? Who are they getting away from? You know, what are they being moved to do when they are activated or agitated in their relationships? The Roy family is an emotional system who, despite not being very likable, actually make things work most of the time. They've made things work so well for such a long time. They know each other so well. They know what buttons to push, don't they? They know just the right amount of togetherness and separateness. And that's what kind of keeps it all functioning, even if it's a very tenuous level until it really, you know, falls apart. So how much togetherness and how much separateness people need in relationship is completely different in every relationship. And how sensitive people are to having too much or too little is often shaped by their own experiences growing up in relationships. And this can play out in all sorts of different ways. But this is what makes relationships so interesting and so different. What different people and relationships can tolerate and find comfortable or comfortable is really unique to them. And so there's a lot to be curious about in all of those. So just think about how this dance of togetherness and separateness plays out in all sorts of relationships. So, for example, think about your workplace. When someone disagrees with the boss and it gets a bit awkward, what conversations happen in the coffee break? You know, what subtle moves are there to find out what people think and if they agree or disagree or whose side they're on? What about how do you react when you see social media posts of friends doing something without you? When do you find yourself allergic to yet another diary date filling up your social calendar? What about at church? How do people know what the culture is to fit in around what's not communicated out loud? Who is invited quickly to the pub after church or out to lunch? And who needs to attend for weeks on end before they're noticed? What about if you're in a marriage relationship or an intimate relationship? What about with your spouse? Who gets reactive to more or less time in the relationship? We all migrate to things that we find more or less comfortable in our relationships, but these are just the natural moves of this togetherness and separateness that we do. Now, things get really uneasy when the seesaw becomes imbalanced and someone's move to more togetherness or more separateness can come across as what is a threat in the relationship. So we think about that as our seesaw. This is when we automatically respond to the tension and stress that's stirred up in the relationship. So we respond to, for example, someone moving towards more separateness as a threat if we feel like there needs to be more togetherness, or vice versa, the other way. If someone seeks more togetherness and that feels a bit suffocating, that can come across as a threat and kind of really stir us up. We respond to this kind of feeling uncomfortable or uneasy in relationships in a really similar way that we respond to feeling anxious in other ways too. So it's important to notice here, or to know that when we're talking about anxiety here in this context, I'm not talking about a big A anxiety like generalized anxiety disorder or something clinical like that. When I'm talking about anxiety, what I'm talking about is the stress of arousal or the emotional drive that every human experiences when we perceive a threat or a challenge. So it might not be experienced as a mental health symptoms, although it can. But when stress or energy triggers a response and undermines our feeling of emotional well-being, we act mostly in ways that will immediately reduce the effect. So, for example, if you think about as anxiety is talked about most commonly, the experience of having the fight, flight and freeze response in our bodies, these are natural and automatic ways that the body responds when it's faced with a threat, or something that it perceives as a threat, that the brain has perceived as a threat. And what happens in this is that it's the body's way of equipping itself with the resources that it needs to manage the threat. What happens is that adrenaline is released and blood is pumped through the body so that it has the energy to fight or to flight in response. And I've got a picture of Neapolitan ice cream up there because a writer who I really like, Kathleen Smith, says, there's something very helpful and very boring about knowing these three responses because there's actually only a limited repertoire of what we actually do when we become anxious. And in anxiety treatment, clinically, this is one of the ways that we actually manage and treat anxiety. It's actually understanding and learning and knowing what these responses look like and feel like in the body, and understanding it and knowing it and managing it, that is part of the recovery effort. And so the boring repertoire is actually really helpful in that sense. Now, one of the things we have learned about relationships over time is that when relationships are feeling pressured or anxious or under stress, there's also similarly a limited and predictable repertoire of responses. But there's four of them. That's why we're branching out with the ice cream flavours. There's a bit more. So there's fight, conflict. There's flight, emotional or physical distance, or we can move into fixing in the relationship and over-functioning for others, or someone under-functioning as well, inviting someone else into that, and fretting to others, triangling, which we'll talk about, is kind of talking about people and kind of pulling other people on side-taking in relationships rather than kind of managing the relationship one-on-one. So just like the body's reaction to stress or anxiety, these things happen automatically in relationships, and they're different mechanisms and patterns that we adopt as knee-jerk reactions to things when they feel uncomfortable to try and get things comfortable again. So if we just think about these being predictable patterns in relationships, being moved to do something automatically in a relationship can look like letting out steam and fighting about it. That's the fight response. Distancing from the tension and avoiding it. Rushing in for a quick fix to try and resolve the problem. Or telling someone else about it, which is sharing the anxiety load so it doesn't actually feel as acute or as strong. So it's worth thinking about what you notice about your own patterns of managing tension or stress and what they might be. What do you actually do when you feel anxious or stressed? How do you handle this? Do you get oppositional and want to kind of fight someone or argue it out or really tease it out? Do you avoid people? Do you talk to others and try and find someone to empathize with you and make you feel better about the situation? Or maybe you go immediately in for problem solving to try and shift things a bit? One of the things I want to say is that it's really important that we don't kind of pathologize these things or call them unhealthy in themselves. The research on relationships in family systems theory actually shows that we all do all of these things, and a little bit of them and a spread of them is actually what makes relationships manageable. But it's so, you know, I guess in that sense, we all talk to other people about other people as a way of communicating with others. We move to fix things for others because we care for them or want to relieve some pressure on them. And we argue because it's actually really good to have different ideas to other people. Wouldn't it be awful if we didn't? But what happens is when things get really intense in a relationship, that these same patterns can get stuck. And they can become the only way that we try and deal with things. And so you get extreme versions of them. So you get cutting off and avoidance in relationships. You get intense conflict that goes round and round. You get people over-functioning for others while others kind of collapse in their own functioning or kind of really lose confidence in themselves. And you get gossiping about other people to feel better rather than having the right conversations with the right people. So when relationships get more intense, whether it's from inside the relationship or outside pressure, you get more intense versions of them. So I just want to say something about sin at this point. And I, you know, I think this is where we're trying to grapple with an intersection between a secular psychological theory and what the Word of God says as well. But here's just a piece of my thinking about it. It's really important for us to think about sin in this context as well and how it can play out in these relationship processes, even if they are natural and automatic and they're things that happen often at quite a subconscious level. I think like all things in our broken world, that sin has the ability to corrupt even these natural processes and to distort them to selfishness and self-interest. So for example, while there is an attention to self which in which observing these things can actually be loving and helpful in relationships as we seek to interact better and manage ourselves better in the process, I think we always need to be careful when we're thinking about what this looks like. So I think seeing patterns in relationships can really easily fall in a spectrum which can end up about being at one end, diagnosing the problems in others and not seeing the plank in our own eyes, or being really quite selfish and self-obsessed where we don't think about the effect that we have on others and where a self-absorption means that we actually lose sight of what it means to be in relationship with other people and in community with them, a real navel-gazing kind of mode to this. I think the sin that places ourselves at the center of our at the center of our own hearts, this is the sin that can corrupt relationships, even at this very base level. Maturity in relationships, and I think what we're actually called to, is one where attention to self is about managing ourselves well in relationships and being honest about this and staying connected to one another in the process. There is an emotional maturity in this, but also a spiritual maturity which recognises the sin that corrupts our hearts and recognises the selfishness for what it is and also seeks to take responsibility for it in relationships. I would love to hear more of your thinking on that. We don't, you know, we could do a whole, you know, session on it. But anyway, just wanted to share a piece of my thinking about that. So this is where our second point is. Where is your emotional energy going? So one of the key questions to ask in any relationship, I think, is where is your emotional energy going? Just listen to these kind of statements and think about how much mental and emotional energy you spend on any of these things. Wondering whether someone likes you. Wondering whether you're annoying someone. Detecting potential upsetness in others. Assuming you know what people think or need. Trying to be the kind of person others want you to be. Worrying about other people's reactions. Trying to get approval, attention, or agreement from others, and trying to get other people to behave better. Now, the thing about emotional energy is the more energy that you put into this kind of relationship focus, the less energy you have to direct to yourself or to work on managing yourself better in the relationship and being more of a self, more of a solid self in the relationship. And in fact, the more energy you put into this relationship focus, the more anxious that relationships are going to be, because you can imagine how that plays out, what you're scanning for as that goes on. So if we think about this question around emotional energy, how much of your emotional energy is directed at changing other people? This might come across in some of this language. Any parent here might identify, this happened in the last hour before I left the home. You need to do this. You should. If you just did X, things would be much easier. What about if we redirected that back into ourselves, back into what we can actually control, which is not other people and how they react? I think I am willing to, I'm working on. This is about emotional energy going back into what we've been given in what we can actually manage, which is how you think, what you do or don't do, and how you communicate that to other people. Again, it's a fairly limited repertoire in some ways when you drill it down, but when we think about how much energy is being poured out into relationships in wanting other people to think the same as us, wishing they did things differently, wanting them to change compared to how much energy we're actually putting back into what we can actually control, I think that's a really interesting question about what sort of dilemmas we're facing. Let's just look at this question of emotional energy and how it can play out with conflict in a couple as an example, but we could extend it to kind of conflict further afield as well. So here I'm drawing on the research of John Gottman. So Gottman is a couple therapist who's been around forever and whose research was developed by observing thousands of couples and actually wired them up in his love lab to monitor their reactivities and the way they related. So super, super interesting research and lots to draw on there. So in his research on conflict, Gottman distinguished two different types of conflict, which he called perpetual conflict and resolvable conflict. And this is what he says. In classifying the discussions of these couples' major areas of continuing disagreement, we found that 69% of the time they were talking about a perpetual problem that they'd had in their marriage for many years. Only 31% of the discussions involved situationally specific problem solving. So do you hear what he's saying there? So almost 70% of what couples argued about were things that were unresolvable, things that went round and round and round that might have come up, years before, come out of their families, and kind of this emotionally driven conflict. And only 30% was solvable conflict. I think what is helpful here, as Gottman really emphasises in his own work, is that conflict is inevitable and even healthy in relationships and to be expected. Gottman actually encourages couples to think of these relationship problems as inevitable, and that actually it's like learning to live with a physical ailment is what he talks about. How you manage it is the key difference. They don't go away, but we learn to manage them better. In systems thinking, we would go further to say that just as predictable are the patterns in distancing, over and under functioning in a relationship, and triangling as a way of diffusing tension in a relationship. But I think this idea that 70% or almost 70% of conflict is unresolvable is a really key factor in relationships. That resolving things or making them go away is not always an option. And when we get fixated on that, this is when the emotional energy can be poured out in relationships into things that are just not in our control. We try and change other people. We try and solve things that are unsolvable, wishing that other people were different so that things were easier. Often wishing or asking them to say or think or do things differently, or just being frustrated that they don't. It's a really good example, I think, in this of how much energy can get wrapped up in that process. But Gottman's research, I think, helps us see that the reality is that most conflict is about things that don't get resolved. And so what matters most is actually, what he says, the affect around how the conflict is discussed. And what that means is how each person regulates themselves in the face of conflict. How are they able to stay calm and connected and listen to each other, even though they disagree? How do they share what's important to them and manage themselves enough to kind of stay in the relationship. And that's what he means by affect in that. Now, this is each person's responsibility and the way each person can take responsibility for themselves in the relationship. And I think a really good example of what it means for emotional energy to be back in yourself. So what does it take for you to kind of calm down, stay connected, stay listening, share some thinking in the relationship? So I just think that's a really interesting kind of example. Now, I'm going to do a very quick deep dive, I think, into an idea. Am I going to do this? Yes, I'll do it. For those who are interested in a bit more theory around this, so take it or leave it, whatever you want to do. Before we get to thinking about working towards more mature relationships, I just want to share this idea from systems theory about fusion, because I think it helps us to understand the difference of what we might describe as less mature relationships and relationships where there's a lot of reactivity going round and round and emotional energy being invested in others, and what healthier or more mature relationships might look like. So in fusion, there are two aspects to fusion that are worth getting our bearings on. The first is that fusion describes the fusing between, on the left-hand side here, our thinking and feeling when we're under pressure. This is the idea that, as a lot of research in neuroscience points to, when we are emotional or stressed or anxious, or our thinking, what happens is that our thinking can get overridden. And what happens is that we actually find it more difficult to distinguish between what we're actually thinking and what we're feeling. It's really difficult to access your prefrontal cortex, which is this front part of your brain, which is your thinking brain, when emotion is high. So ask any parent of an adolescent about this, as adolescent brains are at like peak vulnerability in this process. But the reality is, at a lower degree of intensity, this is really true of all of us. The default at this point is just to react without thinking, because our neural pathways are not connected enough to our prefrontal cortex to be able to access our thinking. So we just react. This is what the brain does automatically when it's wired to respond to a heightened threat or emotion. And when this happens, it can lead to a kind of stuckness because we're not able to see alternatives. We can't kind of think our way out of it, and we kind of get a real tunnel vision. The second aspect of fusion is that when relationships are under pressure, we also fuse into a kind of togetherness that takes comfort from the relationships around us, and we can lose our sense of self in this. So what happens is it's like the group think takes over, and it can be difficult to hold our own thinking or our own values or beliefs or different ideas separate to those around us. So even if we might think differently, we might kind of give them up so as to not rattle the group or the relationship. We might even more look to others to gauge how we are. So if they're okay, or they say I'm okay, then I'm okay. So these two aspects, this fusion of thinking and feeling and the fusing with other people, are related. So if you just think about how this plays out, if our thinking and feeling is fused when we're emotional, that is, we can't kind of access our thinking and slow it down and be able to separate or understand what's what, we get more dependent on others to give us feedback about those things. And so we're more dependent on the relationship or the group or the family in that process. And that in turn exacerbates the fusion of the thinking and feeling, and that can kind of go round and round in that process. I think that we can see in this that this is how our emotional energy ends up going to other people rather than ourselves. And this sort of focus can really fuel how anxious we feel about the relationship. And actually what can happen is that it can make the relationships more intense and anxious as well, because we're needing more and more from them, if that makes sense. So what's the alternative? The flip side of relationships that are driven by this anxious process are relationships that are more emotionally mature. So instead of thoughts and feelings being fused and confused, working on emotional maturity means, on the one hand, being able to separate thoughts and feelings. So this is about slowing down the automatic reactivity and getting more thoughtful in the process. What this creates, actually, is the ability for someone to work on being calmer as they do this, and increasing their capacity to regulate and respond more intentionally. It's really kind of trying to slow down what happens automatically and to see it. One of my favorite descriptions of what we call differentiation of self, which is emotional maturity, is that it is the capacity to make a choice. So rather than just reacting, when we calm ourselves down and slow ourselves down, new possibilities can emerge and we can make a choice about how we respond. And you can just think about what that can open up in a relationship when we're able to do that. Now, these efforts don't need to be like a dramatic change of position or a major declaration of something, but it's the idea that any person working on this sort of growth for themselves that can create options out of what might otherwise seem stuck. So you might have experience or know what it's like to be in a group that's really highly anxious about something, and the difference that just one person can make if they're able to stay calm and keep their own thinking intact and communicate in the midst of this. A great example is from Jane Austen's book, Emma. I don't know if people have read that or seen that, but there's this fabulous scene where they all go to the Weston's house for dinner, and it starts snowing, and it's like they all get extremely anxious that it's snowing, and how are they going to get back, and the carriage is going to get stuck, and it's like, oh my gosh, the anxiety in the room is just escalating. And meanwhile, Mr. Knightley has just kind of sidled out the door and kind of checked the snow and got the facts around what's happening, and he comes back in and he says, it's actually fine. If we go now, we'll be fine. It's not a problem, you know. And it's just so great. And they all go, oh, okay, well, I guess we better go then. And then they all kind of go. And it's just a great example of how the anxiety can be contagious in the group and that sort of thing, but the difference that one person can make if they're able to hold onto their own thinking, get some facts, and be intentional about how they communicate. So working on calming yourself down, having time to observe what's happening for yourself and other people, and working towards a thoughtful response is all part of this. So on the other side of emotional maturity is this relational piece, where differentiation of self or emotional maturity is the challenge to be able to define your thinking and what is important to you and stay in good emotional connection with others. So Robert Creech, yeah, that's the quote from him there, describes this as a lifelong project. There you go, that's bad news too, isn't it? Of becoming less emotionally fused to others so that we can remain in relationship with them while exchanging less and less of one another's anxiety. So how do we stay in contact with other people in good relationship and not just be kind of a conduit for anxiety and kind of passing that around? Now, emotional maturity is not a cold, hard detachment from others. I always say to people, anyone can be mature if they're not actually in contact with people. I'm very mature when I've got no one around, actually. Maturity is the ability to be able to maintain your thinking and hold on to it, your own values or what's important to you, while being in good contact with other people without being overtaken by the emotional pressure in the relationship. So if we think about our little kind of reciprocal circle going on here. So someone's effort to work on their own emotional maturity can lead to reduction of tension in a group, because suddenly you've got someone not just being a conduit for the anxiety, but actually transmitting calm in the group as well. And what that does is actually create space for others to work on their own emotional maturity in response to that as well. So instead of our automatic tendency to react and go fast and find a quick fix just for the sake of the relationship feeling a bit easier and constantly scanning other people, this is an effort about slowing down and getting more thoughtful and more intentional with other people. And I really do think that when we're able to do this, what we actually offer other people in the process is the opportunity to be themselves, the space to do their own thinking, to work out what's important to them, and to be able to manage themselves too. Now, I think this sort of commitment to loving people, working on being less anxious and reactive ourselves, and giving people the space to do their own thinking can be a real service to others in whatever relationship you're thinking about. And what I want to say about this is that I think while emotional maturity and spiritual maturity are not the same thing, I think they can reinforce each other. And I find the Apostle Paul's word to the Ephesians really penetrates the heart of what being a thoughtful, solid self looks like. This is what he says to the Ephesians. Then we will no longer be infants, tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching and by the cunning and craftiness of people in their deceitful scheming. Now, this this image for Paul and what he says here is a warning for the Ephesians to stay solid in their gospel orientation and not get just caught up in the next set of ideas. But it does resonate for me with the idea of what an attention to managing yourself well looks like, and how this is an effort to withstand the pressure that can come from other people and to stay on course with what's important to you and stay thoughtful with that. And I think emotional maturity is like this, actually. It's not being tossed here and there by the pressures of relationships around you, but being able to stay calm and thoughtful in the midst of this. So, working on relating in relationships. Thinking about emotional maturity is a helpful way to think about the effort towards healthy relationships, because the principles are actually the same, whether it's in couple relationships or in parenting or in your own families or in our friendships or workplaces or churches. So the relationship work, paradoxically, is a solitary project. You can't change another person, even though the temptation is always there to try. And mature relationships are made up of mature people. And this is why it begins with seeing your own patterns in relationships and being willing to be the one to do the work on them. And so the principles are the same because wherever we are, we're bumping up against other humans and we see the same patterns play out in all sorts of different ways. They might be more intense in significant relationships, but we can always see the patterns. And so it's an effort to work on being more thoughtful and intentional. There's our patterns again. Being more thoughtful and intentional and shifting from this end of the spectrum, which is automatic and can be avoidant or assuming and kind of moving in quickly and being driven by anxiety and moving, let's be honest, we're not going to be right up that end of the spectrum, are we? We're just going to kind of shift up that end of the spectrum a little bit more towards being more calm and more having more contact with people and being curious about others in that as well. So what I'm going to do to finish is just finish with some questions to think about how we can observe ourselves and our relationship habits or patterns in some different fields. So if we have a think about at home. Who am I blaming or expecting to change? When do I distance myself or shut down? When do I take over what other people could do for themselves? And do I seek closeness or reassurance from someone when I'm actually annoyed at another family member? What about in your own family of origin, which is your own kind of growing up family? Who do you disagree with the most? And how do you manage that? Who do I have the least contact with in my own family? Do I assume responsibility for someone else rather than letting them try something? Who calls who in my family and who avoids direct contact with others? What about in friendships? Am I able to disagree with my friends or am I just friends with people who think the same as me? Whose texts or calls do I avoid answering? When can my helping be actually getting in the way of someone else's ideas or initiatives? And how much of my conversations with friends are about other people? What about at church or in your workplace or organisation? What do I do when I disagree with someone or something happening at church or in the workplace? When do I notice myself getting involved or avoiding people at church or at work? Could I be doing too much for others just because it makes me feel better rather than actually caring for them or knowing what they need? And when does talking about people turn into gossip about them? These are challenging, aren't they? But they're also very real and very normal, and I think if we're honest with ourselves, we can all see pieces of these in us and think about what is the effort if we are going to work towards being more mature people to help have more mature relationships and healthier relationships. I'm going to finish there, I think, and I'm just going to pop this up. This just by way of more information, more resources in these areas and thinking about relationships. These are a couple of books I think that are helpful. The Bowen Family Systems Theory and Christian Ministry, the one that Michelle mentioned, which has chapters from different Christian people and people in ministry around the application of family systems ideas in Christian ministry or just in pastoral care and all sorts of things. Jenny Brown has written some very accessible material around family systems theory and its application to relationships, so confident parenting and growing yourself up. And then there's websites and stuff as well. I'm going to stop there.